Chat with Traders, Episode 30.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
Hey guys, what's up? Welcome back to another episode of the Chat with Traders podcast. This is episode number 30, and thank you so much for taking the time to tune into another episode of the podcast. It's awesome to have you listening. Now, this week, we're taking things up a level. I had the honour of interviewing the legendary market wizard Tom Basso, president of former money management firm Trendstat. Tom started his working life as a chemical engineer, often discussing stocks and investing with colleagues. As he started to experiment with trading from a $2,000 account, there was no beginner's luck in sight. Tom consecutively lost money for the first few years before things started to turn around. With a series of events that followed, Tom went from trading his own money to forming Trendstat and managing other people's money. At the peak of his career, Trendstat managed $600 million of capital. And while Tom's now retired, he still actively studies and continues to trade. This week's interview covers many topics that range from trend following and systematic trading to psychology and why you must never forget to enjoy the ride, which is most important of all. Just before we roll into it, I'd like to highlight there were a number of challenges recording this interview. Firstly, this was recorded a few weeks ago when I was fighting through a cold and we had some challenges with the audio equipment. And we also had to record this interview in two parts. Then just to top it off, there was a thunderstorm that rolled through midway. But I'm hoping you can look past this because the knowledge and experiences that Tom shares over the next hour or so is invaluable. All right, guys, I'm your host, Aaron Fifield. This is Chat with Traders, and here is this week's guest, Tom Basso. Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Aaron.
Excellent. Great to hear. I mean, it's awesome to be speaking with you, and I must say before I go any further, thanks so much for being open to an interview and making the time to come on. It's really a true honour to be speaking with you.
It's totally my pleasure.
Yeah, so I mean, like, earlier this week I was going through, I reread your Market Wizards interview and I listened to a bunch of your interviews on Michael Covill's podcast, and they're all really insightful, and so I'm excited to hear what you're about to share with us today. And I mean, there's no doubt that listeners are going to take away a lot of valuable wisdom from this discussion. So just before we get into it too much further, for those who may not already be familiar with you, they might just be getting into trading or just starting to get into the world of finance, would you like to give us just a quick 30-second snapshot of who you are and kind of what you're most well-known for? And then I've got a bunch of questions about where it all began for you.
Sure. I'm, of course, the former creator and president of Trendstat Capital Management. We were had about a 28-year run or so. I started out as a chemical engineer and got into trading. And one thing led to another. First, I was trading stocks, and we got into bonds a little bit and traded a few options and got into futures trading, expanded that to about 80 different markets and futures, and eventually got into currency trading, which is the bulk of our money at the end. But we still traded mutual funds and futures. And at our peak, we handled about $600 million of other people's monies. We were registered commodity trading advisors in the U.S. and registered investment advisors as well in the U.S. Shut that down in 2003 and enjoying retirement the last 12 years or so.
Okay, that's excellent. I mean, that's a really impressive way to kick this off. So I'm keen to hear how you very first got into trading and what was it that initially attracted you to the financial markets?
Well, what happened is as a chemical engineer, I realized that there was sort of boom and bust in the United States in the economy. Every time there was a boom, they'd hire engineers, and every time there was a bust, they'd lay them off. And not wanting to get laid off and at least wanting to have a backup plan, I decided I'd better save some money as I was earning it. And as that got to be a little bit of a larger quantity of money, I decided I should do something with that rather than sticking it in the bank. And some friends of mine that were also chemical engineers at lunch would talk about the stock market, so that intrigued me, and we started a stock portfolio, and so I could participate in the conversations as well, and that led to an investment club where we ended up eventually running the club, and that ended up into a small investment advisory business, and teamed up with another couple fellas, and got that going. That grew into a substantial size, and I eventually sold my share of that company and formed Trendstep. And Trendstep then was my way of trying to not only manage my own money, but manage my client monies as well. And we just kept growing that over time and evolving in complexity, number of markets, and so on until we became the success that we became.
Okay, excellent. So let me just take it back to when you mentioned there that you sort of started out as a chemical engineer. Were there any skill sets that you learned as an engineer which you applied to trading or had some sort of relevance when you sort of brought it over to the markets?
Yeah, the most obvious one that I have noticed over the years, and it certainly applied throughout my Trendstep years in the company, was something called process engineering. And what I refer to that as is one of the first lessons you learn as a chemical engineer is the old pipeline comes into a tank, the tank is full of water, and there's a pipeline going out of the tank. And you learn how different flows coming into the tank will fill the tank over certain amounts of time. And you'll learn that flows going out take water out over time. And when you have them coming in and going out at different rates, then you need to be able to calculate how much water is going to go up or down in the tank. And so process engineering, in my mind, always becomes stuff coming in, stuff being processed, and stuff shipping out. And Trendstep Capital Management was a perfect example of that. We had all sorts of downlinks and internet connections and everything, bringing in data continuously, in some cases tick by tick. Then we were an operation that did nothing but process that information. So we had 40 computers and 10 people at our max that were just doing nothing but crunching a lot of data. And then there's the flow out. The orders, the communiques, the updates to websites, and all that. So to me, that was just process engineering. Bring in the information, process the information, ship information out. And the faster and better and more efficient you can do that, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting. So just still sort of sticking with that journey as you were starting out, if we were to zoom in on your first few years, what do you recall your experience being like?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind brings a smile, because the first few years, I would say, were pretty much losses and me making mistakes and just sort of wandering and trying to find my way. I looked at things like fundamentals, and I took several newsletters, and I read opinion after opinion to the point where I was totally confused. And I realized that sooner or later, a trader has to take individual responsibility for what he or she is going to do. And the only way you're going to do that is to simplify everything down so that you can say, this is how I'm going to trade. I'm going to take this data, I'm going to examine it or process it, and there's going to be a flow of orders that goes away from me. And when I do that efficiently and religiously and in terms of in discipline, that's where I'm going to be able to analyze whether that approach is working or not working, modify it if it's not working, improve it, and keep getting better and better as a trader. And so the first couple of years were actually losing years, and it required a tremendous amount of foresight strategic knowledge and patience on my part to just keep doing it, because, you know, it's kind of like, how many times do you want to beat your head against the wall before you stop? And there was certainly plenty of that in the first few years.
Okay, that's great, Tom. So I think it's fair to say most of us will probably never forget our very first trade. So tell us, do you remember your first trade, and how did that turn out for you?
I don't remember the specific trade, but I would remember that it was a stock that I bought. And I think I bought it based on somebody having a hot tip. I want to say it was Alcan Aluminum somehow way back when. And I realized well into the trade that I had no idea how this particular tip that I was given had anything to do with the financial well-being of Alcan Aluminum, and that I had no idea of how to get out of the thing once I got into it. I didn't even have the ability to chart it or do anything. So I just really felt like a completely a fish out of water. I had no idea what I was doing. I realized it fairly quickly. And thankfully, I did not lose too much money on that one. I did lose, I believe, but I thought it was an interesting educational experience.
Okay, sure. And I mean, you touched on this sort of a little bit earlier, and I think I read this in your Market Wizards interview, but is it true that you, when you very first started, you actually lost money for 5 years consecutively, sort of one after another?
That would be referring, Aaron, to my commodities trading. I took about, I think it was the fourth year, perhaps, where I at least broke even. So I traded for, first year lost money, next year lost less money, next year lost less money, finally broke even, and it probably took me to about 4 or 5 years, roughly, to where I was actually producing a reasonable profit.
Okay, so I think there's a couple really valuable sort of notes we can touch on there. The first one would be, how were you able to lose money for 4 or 5 years, yet continue trading? And secondly, what was it that motivated you to keep pushing on and not to give up?
Okay, the first question is, in terms of how was I able to keep doing it, is I was a chemical engineer. I was actually at a day job. I was making good money. We were in great demand back in the oil embargo days in the 70s and 80s. And I ended up with a nice job, lots of promotions. I was highly ranked in my daytime job. I always got the best raise, the best promotion, and eventually had moved over into the business side of the chemical industry, and was still trying to advance down that road while I was trying to become a better trader at the same time. And because of that, I had cash flow, and because I always kept my trading very small, and as I was trading and losing small amounts of money, I was easily able to not only replace the losses, but to increase the size of my account, to improve diversification, to improve the numbers of volatility and risk controls and things that I was learning how to do at the early stages. Some of that just requires more capital, and I just worked real hard and tried to save as much as I could and keep adding to the account. And why I was able to keep going was that I saw that every year, when I looked back at the year and tried to decide which direction am I taking in the future for the coming year, I could always see that I had made progress, that I had made less mistakes, that I lost less money, that I had captured more of the types of moves that I was trying to capture. And it kept me thinking that I'm on the right path and I just need to keep refining it and getting better and getting more diversified and keep my costs down. And little by little, I finally got there. It took a long time.
Okay, good one. And just looking back on that time, of course, with the power of hindsight, is there any way that you feel as though you could have potentially shortened that learning curve from the point of first starting out to where you've reached a level of profitability?
Well, yeah, in today's world, I probably could a little bit, in that there's all sorts of some of the brokers will give you free practice trading types of softwares and on the websites and things that would allow you to run tests that, for very little or no money as an inducement to get you to trade your account through them. Interactive Brokers comes to mind, interactivebrokers.com. And but there's others too. And there's lots of software that you can either buy or use in various levels of sophistication that would allow you to test certain ideas out and cover a variety of data. In my days, I literally had Wall Street journals. I saved everyone religiously. When I did a study, it would be pulling out the Wall Street Journal day after day after day after day and sticking it on a piece of paper, because many computers or microcomputers haven't even been invented yet. So I'm doing this all by hand. I'm using chart paper to chart the things, and I'm running a study over a course of a couple years of data. It would take me an entire weekend to just try to run some idea on one particular market for maybe a few years of data by the time I was all done. And it was cumbersome and tediously boring and tediously slow to get it done. But I knew that once I had certain things done, that I could use that and understand what I was going to get on the good side and what I was going to get on the bad side. It also forced me as a trader to live in the moment of those trades day by day in the data, in the historical data. So many times I think today traders have such fancy, sophisticated software that you can run 20 years of data against 60 different markets and you get some number at the end that says you made 12%. And there's no understanding of how that 12% was made in the detail. It's just the final page of the study that comes out and it gives you all these fancy statistics. You say, oh, I like that, I'll do that. But you don't live with the trades day by day and realize the types of things that could have happened intra-trade that you have to be able to psychologically live with. Well, because I was doing everything by hand, I guess good or bad, it was good that I ended up being able to really understand how a trade evolved day by day because I was doing it all by hand. There wasn't any computer program back in those days.
Sure, that's really interesting. And like you mentioned, the Wall Street Journal there, was there anything else you were doing to sort of educate yourself on the subject of trading?
Read a lot of books, and we had our lunchtime crowd that would exchange ideas. Those were the two ways I kept expanding my brains.
And during sort of this period up to your first maybe 10 years in the markets, were there any points that forever changed the way you approached trading, like any aha moments, realizations, or sort of hard lessons that will forever stick with you?
There was one that I talked to Jack Swagger about in New Market Wizards that is etched on my memory, and it involved the hunt foreigner on silver way back when. I can't even remember the year anymore. I'm going to say it was in the 80s. And I was long silver, as I was supposed to be. And I had about, I think at that time, my futures account might have been, I'm guessing, between 70 to 100,000 right in there. It's gotten to be a decent size account now, but it was relatively small. And all of a sudden, silver starts streaming upward, and I've got, I forget how many, like 4 or 5 contracts of this stuff. And I'm looking at my equity in my account, and like today it's 125,000. The next one it's 150,000. It's 175,000. It's 200,000. It got all the way up to 500,000 on this one trade, and my account was going up and down, 25,000 to 50,000 a day. As they got near the top, it got very frothy. And darn it, I'm a good trend follower at that point. I'm going to stay with this trade and let the trade run, let the winner run, cut the losses short. You know, that's the rules. You got to do it. And I was just so disciplined about it. And by the time it got back to my stop loss point, which I had moved up and followed the trend, I ended up netting out about a $250,000 account out of it, and which on the surface of everything would seem to be, you know, what's wrong with that, right? I mean, we started with, 50 or 75, and we ended up with 250. That's a good trade. And it certainly was very profitable. But when I sat back at the end of it, and I thought of the nerves that I had to put up with to live through that trade, I thought, wait a second. Should I have really had five contracts or whatever it was throughout this entire trade? Or would it have made more sense to have a proper exposure and to stay with the trade during the entire trade all the way to the end, but when the markets got insane, to hold less of that position so that as a portfolio, all of my instruments in the portfolio would have a somewhat equivalent ability to produce profit or to create loss, and they would be able to diversify each other a little bit. In this one case, the silver so dominated my portfolio that I might as well not even been trading anything else. And I thought that didn't seem right to me, so I started doing a lot of research on volatility as a percent of equity in my portfolio, and started from that point on creating the early stages of what Trendstat eventually very successfully used over the years, which was our volatility controls. And along with that, the risk controls evolved, and we used those at Trendstat as well, which was limiting the risk of the particular market to my portfolio and limiting the volatility that it contributes to the portfolio, both as a percent of equity. I think once I had those two things in place, performance got a little more predictable, got a little bit more consistent, profitability got, I think, strangely a little better. I guess it allowed me to put the proper number of contracts on so that one market didn't dominate the losses too much. But that led to, I ended up ultimately, even with margin as a percent of equity controls in a couple of instances in Trendstat, and we had the ability then to put together real portfolios that had real diversification, that had real abilities to have all the markets help contribute to the profits or losses. And that was a real aha moment to me, because living through that silver trade, wow, it pretty much is the way to keep yourself up at night.
Something I just want to touch on that you mentioned there, and that was about volatility control as a percentage of equity. Can you just elaborate on sort of what you really mean by that, and maybe how this is something that other traders could adapt to better sort of manage their capital?
Sure, it's easy to do, and I'll give you the exact formula. It's take a market and figure out for one contract of a futures market, figure out how much the highest high of the day and the lowest low of the day is worth is a range in dollars or whatever currency you're living with, in our case, U.S. dollars. And you'll come up with that number, and that's its volatility of one contract for that market for that day. I would average, I use an exponential average, but you can use whatever you want. It all works similarly. I'd use a 20-day average of that daily volatility. So that gives me sort of the last 20 days of how much is this thing moving up and down. Is it moving up and down for contract $1,000? Is it moving up and down $200? Is it moving up $500? Whatever it is, it's just telling you that this is how much this thing has speed to it. It is going to dominate, you know, it's going to contribute when it's going your direction that much per day, and it's going to potentially hurt you that much a day if you're in the wrong way. Once you have that number, then I just divided it by the dollars of equity in my account. So let's say you're trading $100,000 and that particular market was moving highest high to lowest low, it would be maybe $1,000 in any one day. Well, that one contract would then have a 1% volatility to equity, 1,000 divided by 100,000. Now, what I used to do, and I can't even remember the numbers now, it's been so long, but we used to set at Trendstat for some 80 different markets we ultimately traded. Each market would have a very specific, by how we were trading it, level of volatility that it would be capped at, and we would never let it get above that. So every day, the computers were taking the data, you know, recrunched the 20-day moving average of the volatility, recrunched the equity that we now have because we either made money or lost money today, so the equity's changed, come up with a new percent equity for percent volatility to equity of every single of the 80 markets. It would compare them to the allowed limit of each of those markets, and it would give us a set of orders to peel off markets if we ever had any that got over the volatility level. And you would just sell them off at market the next day.
Okay, excellent. Thanks for sharing that with us, Tom. That's really good. Mm-hmm. Something I'm keen to ask you about, and that's kind of your mindset and where you were at sort of in your head during your sort of 20s, when you were getting into trading there during those early years. Did you always envision yourself as reaching the high levels of success that you were able to achieve? Like, I'm always interested to know if you had that long-term vision and a long-term goal that you were sort of working towards. You knew where you wanted to get it. You knew where you wanted to get. It was just a matter of how you were going to get there. Like, did you always picture you would reach the massive success that you reached later in life?
I didn't even picture that I would be a professional money manager when I started out. I was a chemical engineer. I was simply looking for a way of trying to manage some money on the side, and I assumed that if I was successful at running my own portfolio, I perhaps could retire a few years early from being a chemical engineer. But I was happy at the early stages of being a chemical engineer. I was paid very well for it. Chemical engineers, when they came out my year in 74, were one of the highest paid engineering disciplines because of the oil embargoes and everything. So life was pretty good for a young single 20-something that's making more money than he's spending, and it's piling up in his account, and he is learning how to trade, and I just assumed it would be a side portfolio and that I would somehow be able to increase my net worth, and I'd have the backup in case I was ever laid off, and life was good. Little by little, what happened was, as people found out I was having some success with my own portfolio, the investment club evolved into sort of, hey, why don't you do what you're doing for yourself with some of our money? That led to a certain limit on the number of people I could do that for before all of a sudden now you've got it registered as an investment advisor. And then running into two other friends that ended up getting into the investment advisory business with me, and little by little, things just, I still figured we'd just do this on the side and, you know, do it part-time at night or on weekends, and, you know, it'd be a second source of potential income. But it was still just a way to manage the money and defray the expenses of taking all these services, and the cost of registration in the U.S. is, you know, there's some money involved in that. And what ended up happening, much to my amazement, is on a part-time basis, we ended up making enough money off of our business to where we could pay one salary full-time. So I said to my two partners, I said, you know, you guys have kids and all that, and you can't really travel. You're tied down a bit more. I'm still, you know, I don't have any children. I got a lot of flexibility. How about if the company pays me my salary that I'm making now at the chemical company, and allow me to leave and open up the offices, and let's take this serious and make it a full-time, you know, successful business. They agreed. I left, started everything, started traveling and meeting clients and putting business on the books and creating computer systems and hiring secretaries and signing office leases and doing all the things that you have to do. And one thing led to another, and pretty soon I got the second partner out, and before long the third partner joins us. We add more staff. The whole thing becomes a wild success.
That's excellent. So let's get into that a little bit deeper about once Transstat was formed, and talk to us about how you were trading at Transstat. I believe that it was a totally systematic sort of operation. So can you just sort of shed some light on that topic?
Yeah, Transstat really, the name of the company was coined by myself, and it's just the trend following statistics, abbreviated to Transstat. S-T-A-T is statistics, and trend is the trend following or trend of the markets. And I felt like if you could just take and collect lots of data on lots of different markets, determine the trend, and then always position the portfolios in line with whatever that trend was, that over time there were going to be large movements, large trends that ended up paying your way for the most part. A good statistic that I would cite was in the first year at Transstat, I did an analysis of where we made money and where we lost money, and I actually ranked the trades from the most profitable trade during the year to all the way down to the largest loser of the year. And we were running about 30-something percent reliable in terms of our trading. That is to say, 30% of our trades would be profitable and 70% of them would be losers. But it turns out that one year, two trades that were so largely profitable that if you had not gotten those two trades in your portfolio, you would have broken even for the year. That's how lopsided it was to the two trades that ended up being so blockbuster and so unbelievable that you had to have them in your portfolio. If you didn't, you were just going to break even that year. That got me thinking, I've got to make sure, you know, with no excuses, that I always get every one of those two or three large trades every year that are going to be there for the most part over time. And those are going to be what's going to pave the way. And the rest of it is a whole bunch of hard work to get nowhere. And that was really what led me to the kind of just expanding the number of markets that I traded, because it put bets, if you will, in more markets, giving you that many more opportunities to catch that one or two in those particular markets. And I never knew which market ahead of time or which trade I was making was going to be that big winner, but I wanted to make sure that I had as many chances of catching them as possible. And so I just kept buying more and more computers, and we had at the peak, including myself as an engineer, we had three full-time computer experts that were doing everything from programming to hardware to keeping the networks running to backing things up to backup facilities off-site, all sorts of things. And it just became a data processing facility, really. A lot of people used to think of me, and still do, as a trader, and yet a lot of times when I was in the middle of Transstat, I was thinking of myself as the president of this data processing company more than I was a trader. You know, I realized, looking back at it, I definitely was a trader. I had to create all these programs. I had to tell my programming people what I was trying to go for, and that was being a trader. But you know, if you woke up and followed me around all day, you'd kind of be wondering how would anybody think that I was a trader?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, actually, how you sort of mentioned that and you sort of almost called yourself or the company just the data processing hub, pretty much, instead of a sort of what you typically think of when you think of a trader. I think that's quite funny. So generally speaking, was there any human interaction with the trading systems during a typical trading day at Transstat there?
No, there was zero. What we did was we built lots and lots of computer programs that we would take data in. We would run the programs once a day against that data, and then decisions would be made by the algorithms that we had built into the computers, and prints would come off, and the human beings would just scan it to look for any kind of computer malfunctions or data malfunctions or anything that looked strange to anybody. Because that would be the last chance we would have to catch an error that maybe of our computers through our poor programming perhaps might have created. But once we knew that everything looked normal, the data looked normal, The data passed all the data checks that we did. The orders were created, hit the button, and out they go. And all of that was automated. The only thing the human beings would have to do was start the process to run the orders, visually scan them to see if anything looks strange, and hit a button to transmit them all. That was the only thing the humans did.
Okay, sure. So Trendstat was sort of in full effect during, I think it was sort of the 90s, is that correct?
Yes, in various stages.
Okay, so during that time period, was this approach common amongst money management firms, or was this quite sort of new to the space of money management, this sort of systematic and automated approach? Was the technology that you were using reasonably cutting edge for the time?
I would put it this way. I would say that cutting edge would mean very different things to different people, I think. If it was at all cutting edge, it would be sort of us trying to take a longer-term trading strategy across a lot of markets and automate that process. I do believe that during the 90s there were automated traders out there, but they were probably doing more intraday trading and what we call straddle trading, pairs trading, those types of things. It seemed like a lot of the automation was concentrating more on the very short term, and we were just the opposite, concentrating on fairly long term, but doing it in a systematic way. So we were probably unusual in that regard.
Okay, sure. And I mean, what I probably should have asked this a little bit earlier, but what was the initial appeal that attracted you to a systematic approach?
That's a good question. I would call it laziness, human being laziness. When I was doing my initial work and I had to have my chart paper out and burn my eyes off every night trying to go through all what the markets did and put in my new data and figure out where my orders were and then create some kind of a fax and then ship that to the trading desk and have them put my orders in for the next day, it was a lot of work. And I realized when personal computers came out, and I was an engineer by background and I knew how to program, I thought, well, why don't I get me one of these things? And I'm just going to program the ability to put the data in and pull it down from someplace and program the computer to do what I do every day. And then it'll generate a set of orders, and then maybe I can print them out and put them in the fax machine. And later on, figured out that there's these things called fax cards that I can, you know, take the print and take it right to the fax machine and out to the order desk. And little by little, I kept eliminating my jobs. And I developed this philosophy of a human being can do something every day. There's two forms of human endeavor, so to speak. There's the artistic, creative side, which I think everybody loves to do, the artsy side, the inventive side. And then there's a lot of things we do as human beings that are just stuff that a machine can do. And it's very repetitive and doesn't require any unbelievable brain behind it, in that if you can put down in a rule-based way exactly how you're doing what you're doing, then you can have a machine do the same rules. You just have to program it into the machine. And so what I try to do at Trendstat is keep everybody as much as possible working on the creative and inventing side of things and let our computers free us of the drudgery of every day. That was the philosophy.
Okay, sure. No, that's excellent. So, I mean, kind of you've talked about your systematic approach, but your actual trading method was, from what I believe, was very much based on a trend-following kind of strategy.
Yes.
So, I mean, what was it about the trend-following approach that you adapted that just meshed with your personality so well? Like, what are some of the key benefits to this approach that you saw?
Well, one of them was that a lot of the major mutual funds and brokerage firms constantly kept saying it can't possibly work. And yet I'd seen people of notoriety that had successfully traded along those lines. In addition, it was mathematical. In addition to that, it fit me because it was more long-term in nature as opposed to trying to worry about what happened in the last hour in the market. And I was a busy guy. I didn't have the time to mess with what happened in the last hour. I was, you know, in the early stages, I was still working as an engineer, trying to do stuff on a part-time basis, trying to get an MBA, trying to build a house out in the woods that I custom designed myself. And there was a lot on my plate in my 20s and 30s. And I just really felt like I had to try to be very efficient about that. And trend following was a way of making sure that I always captured every major trend. And as I told you before, previously, in some years, as many as little as two or three trades would be the difference, a trend set between making money that year and breaking even. So you had to capture every one of those big ones, and trend following would always mathematically capture a very large move. It couldn't fail to do that. And that gave me that reassurance that that's what I was going for. All this other stuff that you do every day, little losses, the two-thirds of the time that you lose money, that's all a lot of work to get you nowhere.
Yeah, and I mean, while we're on the topic of trends, do you find that the structure of trends has changed from, say, 10, 20 years ago to how they are now? Like, is it fair to say that trends might have been much cleaner cut back then, and in today's market, the trends tend to jump around a lot more?
It could be. I frankly haven't taken the time to try to do that kind of analysis in the recent years, and I have been retired 12 years, so... I would say that, yeah, there's some choppiness out there, and a lot of it could be driven by shorter-term computer action, but the way I like to think of the trading world that I have sort of observed over the last three decades, probably, almost four decades now, I guess, you know, I think that the use of computers has set up everything. So in the days when that's lightning and thunder out our window here, in case you hear it in the background.
All right, yeah, yeah.
A little monsoon action in Arizona today.
All right.
I think the whole world in trading can now move, say, a few billion shares where they used to back when I came out of college in 74. A really good day at the end of the 73-74 bear market, which lasted 2 years, was 10 million shares on the New York Stock Exchange. To put that in perspective, SPYs trade hundreds of millions of shares all by itself. One instrument trades literally 20, 30, 40 times the amount that the entire New York Stock Exchange traded in 74. Because they were doing it all by hand. There was tickets, there was telephone calls, there was, you know, a lot of running around and very inefficient approaches to doing everything. So now you can do all that a lot faster, and you can even tell your computer to make the decision faster, to transmit it faster. Everything's sped up. So the way I like to look at it is, I don't know that the trends have changed all that much, but they probably happen a lot faster. So to me, what constitutes a full trend? It's kind of like a large cycle of human psychology when it comes to investing. There's the I don't want to ever get into the stock market again stage. Then there's the stage where stocks start going up, but I don't trust it. And then they go up a little further, and I don't know, maybe I should get into this. And then you start hearing about it at cocktail parties, and you almost have to buy it at that point, and by the time you get around to doing it, it's actually at the high and about ready to reverse that psychology and go the other way. Well, now, a lot of that psychological shift from depression to euphoria seems to happen a lot quicker. We have telecommunications, we have, you know, blogs and all sorts of news coming to our phones, so we know what's the latest on the Greek crisis and what is the prime minister going to say, and there's 25 people analyzing what he's going to say or what he's not going to say, and it's compressing. In the old days, you had to wait till the Wall Street Journal showed up to get some of this stuff. Nowadays, everything's electronic. Everything can react quickly. So I don't know that trends aren't there as much as the speed of those trends. And the psychological changes that go through the market happen a lot faster, I think, than they used to in the old days.
Okay, sure. That's really well said, Tom. When we were initially speaking by email, you observed that there is an obsession, or seems to be an obsession, with predicting rather than being in the now amongst many traders today. Would you like to expand on this? I mean, I feel like you've got some interesting insights to share on this topic.
Well, yeah. To me, I get asked a lot, even at, you know, friends, parties, whatever, you know, that people find out I used to be a trader, and we start talking about investing. It's something that affects almost everybody. And you'll get on conversations about, well, what do you think is going to happen to the dollar? What do you think is going to happen here? What do you think the government is going to do here? And I can carry on an intelligent conversation on economics. I used to have to pretty much know what countries were doing with their currencies, and I'd be fairly well read on that, if for no other reason than during a client interview when some major bank is trying to hire me to manage their currencies, that I can speak intelligently about various economies and at least appear, even though it has nothing to do whatsoever with my trading, to be intelligent and knowledgeable about, you know, various economic things that are going on around the world. And I continue to do that. I followed this whole Euro thing and the Greece thing with fascination, because in 1997, when people were interviewing me, I absolutely 100%, with no punches pulled at all, said that the Euro is a dumb idea and it will never last long term. It cannot. You can't base all sorts of different political systems into a single currency that's based on a whole bunch of different balance sheets. It won't happen. Somebody's going to cheat. Somebody's not going to pull, you know, their weight. Other people are going to be getting the shaft on it and having to pay for the people who aren't doing it right. And that's what you're seeing now. Germany, some of the German people got to be getting fed up with the attitude of places like Greece and Italy and Portugal, Spain, and other places that seem to be, you know, socialist and debt-ridden and don't seem to be able to get their act together at all, financially speaking. And how long are you going to run that until you just say, I've had enough? And then you break it apart again. So I've always thought it was a dumb idea. Well, the prediction of that is all good and fine, but in reality, to trade, all I care about in trading is what should my portfolio be positioned this moment, right now, period. Nothing more than that. You don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. You don't care a whole lot about what yesterday brought, because that's already gone and never coming back. You really need to concentrate on looking at your portfolio. And I've heard Paul Tudor Jones say this on occasion, where he likes to start each day assuming that all his positions are wrong. Like he's starting all over again, and he's reanalyzing where does he want to be right now. And if he assumes that everything's wrong, he's critical then about every position. He tries to decide, no, I do like that position. I want to hold it on again for another day. I think that's trying to force himself to be in the now, and that's a good thing. It's the only thing you have the control as a trader of doing, is buying or selling right now. You can't buy it 3 weeks from now. It's not going to, there's no point to that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up, Tom. That's excellent. So, something else I've heard you talking about in sort of past interviews, maybe this was on Michael Coville's podcast, but you were talking about a coin flip concept. And what you were referring to was sort of how entries are less important than sort of money management and good risk management and exits.
Yeah, I did the random study. I just took the computers and I had them create a random number generator. And at the end of every day, if I didn't have a position in any one of, like, I forget what's how many markets, I think I did 8 markets. Somebody else in Austria replicated it with 20 markets. It came out the same. In fact, they might have even made more money than I did. But we were all slightly positive, not robustly positive, just slightly. But what it came down to is the same concept I mentioned already. If you trade all year long, and two or three trades are the difference between making a very nice profit versus breaking even, then you must be in on those trades someplace. And once you get in on those trades, you need to let them run and mature and bring you those very large profits that you seek. A random number generator that just simply says, okay, I don't care which way I go. Markets could go down a lot, they could go up a lot. I'm just going to flip a coin. Whatever it says, the next morning I'm going to buy the open or sell the open, as the case may be. But once I get that new position, I have to try to assume it's the next really, really big winner that I've got. So I need to trail my stops at a logical level, give it enough room to move, to be safely restricting the risk, but at the same time giving it room for normal movement. So things like average true range, things like breakouts on charts, all of those types of things, depending on what you, how sophisticated you want to be about it, could come into play to give the market normal movement, but to allow that profit to keep building and building and building over the long run for that one trade. As soon as it hits that stop, that tells you, well, that trend was not the one you were looking for that major, you know, that major trade that would pay its way, pay the way for the portfolio to be successful for you. So what you'd end up with is you'd be out of the market and flip it again. Well, a random number is going to give you 50% of them are going to be buys and 50% are going to be sells. It isn't going to be long until you're going to match up with that trend. When you are on that big trend, that's going to make all the money for you, and that's how you're going to make the slight amounts of profit for the year. You're going to have lots of losers, you're going to have some gainers, and you're going to have one or two or three very, very large gainers. And those are the ones you have to be in on, and a random number generator will give you those.
Okay, sure. So I'd like to move it along a little bit now and sort of touch on the subject of psychology. And I think I could almost quote you saying from other interviews that psychology is probably the most important aspect of profitable trading. So why do you believe this to be the most important aspect?
All right, well, I would say good trading falls into three different things that have to happen. The first one, which everybody spends all their time on, is the buy-sell decision. You have to have a way to say, this is how I would buy or sell a market, a stock, or whatever it is that you're trading. Secondly, you'll have to answer the question of how much should I buy and what types of instruments should I buy. I call that whole area the sort of portfolio management, risk management, volatility management area. And you have to be successful at that too. The third area, the most important one in my opinion, and the one that a lot of people spend the least amount of time thinking about, is your own psychology. Because you as the human being, who ultimately, even in the case of fully automated Trendstat back in the day, I had the power as the owner of Trendstat to go in and pull the plug on the computer or override it or do whatever, because I owned the company, 100%. So if my psychology wasn't in good shape and my knowledge of what we were doing comfortable with what we had created, then the first time I go through a drawdown, I'm going to start second-guessing myself and all those computers, and I'm going to start telling my computer staff, oh, we need a whole new way of doing things, and let's go research this latest hot strategy that seems to have made 50% last year. And I could go buy black boxes or build black boxes. What's the difference? And keep switching and trading and fail time after time after time because my psychology wasn't right. So even though I was automated, you still have to have a good, balanced mind about what you're doing. Trading, like for instance, a good example that I've heard Dr. Tharp, Van Tharp, talk about, good trading is following your strategy that day. It is not whether you made money or lost money that day. It's simply following your strategy. And that's a very profound thing. Hit me a long, long time ago when I heard him say that. I thought, yeah, that's perfect. That's exactly what I do every day. And that's why he and I worked together for a few years at least. I helped him out with some seminars he was doing, and I found it fascinating to meet a lot of people around the world. And we had a good time doing them until my schedule got so busy it got unreasonable to do them anymore. But that was a very succinct and smart way of putting it. Good trading is following your strategy. It's not, good trading isn't making money and bad trading losing money. Good strategy development is what you need to do. Once you have that strategy, you need to follow it and to actually execute it. And the time to change your strategy isn't at the heat of the moment, halfway through the trading session when your particular position is going against you by 3% and you aren't sure whether you should pull the plug on it or not. You should have already figured that out, and it should be just blindly done. And when you're out of the position and the markets are closed, if you want to sit back and think about what just went on and try to come up with a better way, all good and fine. I'm not saying anybody shouldn't be constantly striving. I was sitting here, one of the reasons I called you a little bit late today was I got completely mesmerized by some stock research that I was doing. So I still am doing it here at 62 years old, retired. And I think you have to keep working and getting better, but you have to stick to whatever it is that you're coming up with unless you can figure out a better way. And I think a lot of people don't do that. I think they pull the plug on it or they buy the black box and 6 months later they throw it out and they change everything they're doing and they're adding so many layers of filters. I've had people at Facebook give me a message and ask me questions, and I'll say, well, tell me what you're doing and I'll see if I can react to it. And I'll go into this involved explanation of all the different filtering this, and they only do it if the ADX is that, and on and on and on and on. I'm wondering how they ever get a trade to happen. They get so many filters in the thing that they're trying to achieve perfection. And it's so complicated, it's probably not workable, and they're likely to miss those two or three very large trades that are going to pay the way. And because they filtered those trades out somehow. So I encourage people to really understand their own mind. I think some people are a little more cut out for trading than others. I think that sometimes extremely cerebral, highly intellectual, you know, they view themselves as smarter than everybody else, they're brilliant. They sometimes have a hard time with trading because they just know too much. And some of the best traders, if you look at some of the floor traders, the people that have come off the streets that really didn't know a whole lot about investing at all, certainly don't have the MBA or anything, but they're successful traders because they find something that works and they stick to it and they don't let the markets beat them up because they don't really have that mental side of them that wants to analyze and theoretically understand everything out there. They just want to make some money and go home, you know, so that's what they do. And so it's something to think about. Everybody needs to study their own psychology and try to ask themselves, what could they be doing to balance themselves out more so that when they're doing actual trading functions that they can stay in the now, they can analyze where they want to be fairly unemotional about it, and react quickly. That's really what good trading is, and that's psychology. The first two, you can do all the work you want, but if you don't have the psychology, you'll never execute those first two.
Yeah, that's an excellent answer, Tom. Very, very well said. And when Jack Schwager interviewed you for the New Market Wizards, he actually dubbed you as Mr. Serenity because of your cool, calm, and collected style of trading. So, I mean, how were you able to actually achieve this and maintain this evenly keeled mindset, even through times of drawdown?
You know, I've asked myself that question a number of times, and the only thing I can think of that seems to play in my mind about history and, you know, my life looking back is that I was so darn busy doing so many things that didn't involve sitting by a phone or in front of a cold machine. And I had so many varied interests that were outside the markets. I've run into people that in the middle of the night wake up and they want to see a quote machine down by their bed to know what the euro's doing tonight. Or weird, that's obsessive to me. I like golf. I'm going to cook dinner tonight. I like helping other traders. Yesterday was pruning my front yard. I love to do sort of an Italian landscape scheme with everything's flowering. I hand prune all my bushes and trees and do it myself. And there's so many things for me to fill up my day that trading just becomes sort of one of the many, many things. And by doing that, it sort of removes the attention to my conscious brain of all the different pre-crisis is doing this, and oh my God, gold's up $10, and all these different things that go on that could capture your mind and all of a sudden pull you down some kind of a psychological hole. Because I was so busy, because I allowed the computers to do their things, because I spent time programming those computers to do what I wanted them to do, and I knew they were doing that, it sort of gave me that peace of mind to, wonder what I was going to cook for dinner that night, or something else, or concentrate on my golf game, or have fun vacationing someplace. I didn't have to be obsessed with every day, read the paper, read the quote machines, look at the charts, agonize over everything. That's where I think a lot of traders, including Jack, I believe, back in the day when he interviewed me, he was very caffeinated. He New York, fast, go-go personality, constantly, driving, and a lot of the market wizards that he interviewed, some of which aren't around anymore, were pretty fast, high-risk guys in the end, and some of them blew up and didn't make it over the long run. By comparison, I was pretty boring, but where I was unusual was the kind of the systematic, keep it simple, don't get stressed out over it. And I think that appealed to Jack in a way because he sort of wanted to adapt some of that for himself. He was just the opposite, and I think that he found it appealing in a way. And that's probably how that chapter got written somehow. But it was a fun process. I enjoyed Jack. He's a great guy.
Yeah, and just to elaborate on that, also during the interview, with Jack, you spoke about viewing your life like a movie. So what did you mean by this, and how does this have a positive impact on your life, and probably more specifically, a positive impact on your trading?
If you watch a movie, you think about a movie that you've recently gone to see, the scene that is up on the screen right that moment is always going to be the now. So you are allowed to, guess where the plot's going. You might guess right, you might guess wrong. It's kind of like the markets. You might think it's going to go up more, but it might not. But you know what you're looking at right there, because it's on the screen right now. If you pay attention to right now, then you can enjoy and allow a horror flick to horrify you, or an emotional film to make you cry, or a comedy to make you laugh at that moment, because you paid attention and there was a joke there and you said, that's funny. Okay, so your emotions can go all over the place, but you aren't attaching yourself. You know it's a film. It's there for entertainment. You still have your own life, your own beliefs, your own everything inside you. So I like to think of the markets and life as sort of a movie. And you kind of know which way the movie's headed, sort of, but, life throws you a lot of unexpected turns, so do the markets. And I think you just have to, kind of look at it and say, okay, that was interesting, now what are we going to do now? And how do you react to it? And what was your strategy supposed to do during that new information or new change in the conditions? And I think it keeps you a little bit separated emotionally from the actual trade to look at it as a movie than to feel like trading is your life and you're surrounded by it in every way you turn and look. The market, you wake up and you go to the market and you you're checking the market before you go to sleep, and you've got your phone in front of you all day long during lunch. You're not carrying on conversations with people because you're worried about what's happening with the euro. And that, to me, is not watching a movie. That would be kind of losing yourself in the middle of the movie.
Yeah, I like that concept. I found that part of the interview really interesting. So, I'm glad I sort of brought that up and got you to share that with the listeners. I think that's really interesting. So it seems like you've made a conscious effort throughout your years as a money manager, and even still to this day, during retirement, that your way of trading was designed to fit the lifestyle that you wanted to live, and not the other way around.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, again, Facebook and Twitter and all that, I must have like 1,000-something people that follow my Twitter stuff that I put out every now and again. It really started out as me trying to help out my stepson and my brother-in-law know which way I was putting my hedges on and taking them off. And it grew from there to all sorts of people signing up like it was a free service on which direction the market's taking lately or something. So, but I get a lot of calls and messages from people about, you know, how they view how do I trade? How does Tom Basso in his retirement trade? And I hate to be rude, but it almost, I feel like saying to him, why do you care? You should be designing what you do for you. Why would you want to do, I mean, I have a different net worth. I have a different expertise level. I have different computer equipment than you do. I may have different legal restrictions in terms of the markets I can trade. You know, some people live in India and they're asking me questions. I have no idea what the Indian stock market looks like or what the regulations are or what the brokerage conditions there are. Never ever traded an Indian stock. Don't plan to lately unless something changes. I just don't know anything about it. So why are you trying to apply what I'm doing to your life? It'd be better for you to be developing what it is that you want to do on your own. And that's exactly what I've done. I'm in retirement. I do spend a little time trading every day. Some days, like today, as I just mentioned a while back, I got immersed in a little bit of stock research because I had some ideas I wanted to explore and think about. I didn't come to any profound conclusions, sadly, but it did certainly burn up a couple hours of my day, and nothing's changed. Tomorrow I'll do the same thing I did today in terms of trading, but it gives me some pause to think about it and all that. But I'm designing something that I can manage myself, that I can go on vacation and take my PC along and maybe spend 20 minutes to a half an hour a day. That's the most on a vacation I'm willing to part from the vacation. If I can get it all done in a short amount of time, I have an internet connection on a cruise ship, let's say, or wherever, I can get my job done every day, continue to trade my strategy, and it's designed around having me be able to do that. And I find so many people looking at systems and strategies that, man, they have full-time jobs, and I'm thinking, how are you going to do that with a full-time job? You're supposed to be out there talking to customers or building widgets, and how are you going to be able to focus and pull it off? You're going to miss trades. You don't have enough capital to diversify it. You know, there's lots and lots of problems you see right out of the gate. The biggest thing I find with a lot of people is capital. They want to start from nothing, and they'll tell me they've got $2,000, and how do I start trading futures contracts? And I kind of scratch my head on that one because, you know, I have to admit I started with about a $2,000 or $3,000 account, had no clue what I was doing, and I'm sure glad that I figured it out because I ended up losing money for 4 years, and it took a long while to get to where break-even occurred. But as I got larger in size, more diversified, and got better risk control, volatility control, it all came together. I think trying to do all that with $2,000 is mathematically impossible. So people are undercapitalized, they don't have a knowledge of what they're facing, and I think it's sad that they aren't thinking through what should they be doing to design something for them. If everybody listens to this broadcast and could just sit back and say, how could I make my own trading strategy my own, make it exclusively mine, make it fit my lifestyle, my capital, my resources, my expertise levels, they're going to be so much more capable of hitting that psychological sweet spot of being able to stay in the now and do what they need to do because it's theirs. They don't have to worry about what Tom's doing with his stuff or what Michael Covell's doing with his stuff or Jack Schwager with his stuff. It doesn't make any difference. It's only important what I should be doing with my stuff. And I think that's what, if everybody can get that one thing out of this interview, I will have done great service to mankind.
Yeah, absolutely. No, 100% agree with that. And from listening to you in various other interviews, it's clear that you're a big believer in taking full responsibility for all aspects of your life. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on why you feel so strongly about this.
It's empowering, basically. Once I figured out that if I, through trading, was responsible for everything, including, I believe I told you earlier about the tip that I started my stock trading on, and it ended up being a lousy tip, and I had no idea what I was doing, and I blamed the guy that gave me the tip and blamed the company for not doing what it should be doing and everything else. But that's not empowering at all. You have to say to yourself, no, wait a second. I'm the one that called up, put the 100 shares on. I'm the one that's responsible. I'm responsible for figuring out what went wrong there and what would I do to make it better next time, and developing trading strategies. It's all on me. Nobody else is going to do it. Nobody else is responsible. The market is going to go through large ups, abrupt downs. It's going to have a lot of noise at times. It's going to be dull and boring at other times. That's what markets do. You can't blame the market for your problems. You got to take it on yourself and say, what can I do to deal with all of what mankind's going to throw at me over my lifetime? When you answer that question, you'll be developing a pretty good trading strategy that'll suit you. And I think, sadly, around the world today, and Greece is in the news, there's a good example, Greece is not taking responsibility for their own mismanagement. So there's this tendency amongst a lot of various factions of society today to either blame somebody else or to expect somebody else to take care of some of their problems. There's less and less self-responsibility in society today. And I don't think that's leading us in the right direction at all. It seems to me that we're getting lots of governments around the world in trouble financially, more and more defaults. Argentina's not looking too good. Venezuela's a disaster. The United States is spending way beyond its means. We're just a little bigger and stronger and so far so good. But, you know, this whole thing starts caving in. I don't know how the world reacts to that. It's going to end up being pretty messy because there's a lot of governments around the world that are going to be in trouble financially. And when people just stop giving them money to, you know, through government bonds and loans and things, or they inflate their currency by just printing too much of it, the people are going to suffer in that country. And it's going to get nasty if people don't take responsibility and get the job done. So I think that that's the whole thing about self-responsibility to me, is it gives you a little bit of that peace of mind in that you have the ability to do something about it instead of having life kind of throw things at you and you kind of react to them and feel like life is throwing you hard turns and it's this guy's fault for not giving me that promotion. It's that guy or that woman who cut me off today that caused me to veer off the road or whatever. I mean, if you try to take responsibility for everything that happens, then you're going to be a little bit better at reacting and doing what's necessary to lead your life in a good way and make positive contributions to society, make positive contributions to your trading strategy. All of those things are going to be enhanced by self-responsibility.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you touched on so many great points there, but Tom, we should probably start to wrap things up here, but let me ask you one more question. And you like to say, enjoy the ride. You often end tweets with this and these three words. And while they're very simple, I feel like there's a deeper message here. Would you mind sharing that with us? And what's the significance of this phrase?
Well, the significance of it is sort of a philosophical one. You know, life is like a ride where you get your ups and downs and unexpected surprises and all that. And in the end, you're dead. So you might as well enjoy the ride. You know, I think people make too much of some things. I know all sorts of traders that can't quit because they're so addicted to it, they identify themselves as traders. They don't identify themselves as human beings that are fathers and husbands and neighbors to other people. They instead are just immersed in this thing called trading. Or you could say the same thing about people who are teachers or people who are salesmen, people who install shades and blinds. There's all sorts of examples I can tell you about that I have friends that are well past normal retirement, but they just can't stop doing what they're doing because they identify with that. They haven't created an identity for themselves, you know, outside of that. And the enjoy the ride thing is just basically to look at life like a movie, enjoy the ride. Just like most movies, there's unexpected twists and you laugh and you're emotional and you should be able to enjoy all that. Because life's short, and why not do that? There's no point. There's no point to doing anything other than that, really. And I think the ups and downs of the market, you know, when I usually get a signal change and all of a sudden people, I end it, enjoy the ride. You know, it's like today we had the down signal come in at the time we're doing this interview. And it was just midday, and I saw the hedges go on, so I got on Twitter, and I put it out to everybody, and I get 5 new people following me, and it gets shared all over the place, and it's kind of weird from my standpoint, but in reality, I mean, I had a down day today monetarily. I didn't go down as much as the market did, so that was good. I guess I buffered a little bit of risk. If the market continues down, I'll look really good. If the market turns around tomorrow and goes up, you know, I'll look stupid again. And that's fine because I'm enjoying the ride. I'm going to go, you know, work on a beautiful dinner for tonight. And I'm going to enjoy myself during the evening, and I'm not going to think about it a lot. Tomorrow I'll do the same thing again, and I'll continue to enjoy the ride.
That's excellent, Tom. Again, awesome advice. So, well, I mean, this has been nothing short of incredible, and like I mentioned earlier, it's a true honor to be speaking with you. So, again, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today, Tom.
Oh, my pleasure.
And before we let you go, do you want to share with listeners perhaps where they can connect with you on and maybe your Twitter handle?
I'm at Basso, Basso, _TOM.
Okay, good one. We'll make sure to put a link to that in the show notes at least.
The way to get a hold of me is actually on Facebook. Just put in Tom Basso, TOM and BASSO in Scottsdale, Arizona. There's only one of me.
All right, excellent. And we'll put a link to your Facebook profile as well so people can connect with you on there.
That's probably on Facebook because my new granddaughter gets a lot of photos on Facebook, it seems. I'm probably on there more often than I'm on Twitter. Twitter is linked to that. If I do a tweet, it automatically goes to my Facebook page, but it doesn't go the other way around.
All right, okay. It's all connected.
I tend to stay on Facebook more than I do. And the other thing you could always do if somebody has an involved question that's a little bit beyond normal messaging length, I've had people use the same old tom@trendstat.com, which is my old email address from back when I was still in the industry. I've kept the URL. It's still active. So tom@trend for trend following and stat for statistics.com, TrendStat.
All right, excellent. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Tom. I'm sure some listeners will definitely have a few questions for you. So thanks a lot for offering
that. No worries.
All right. Well, again, Tom, thanks so much. Have a good evening, and let's talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Aaron.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.